Welcome to CMAJ Podcasts. I'm John Fletcher, Editor-in-Chief of CMAJ, and with me is Kirsten Patrick, Deputy Editor, and we're discussing the November the 18th issue of the journal. And on the front cover, we have what looks like a glass of milk and a jar of possibly beans.
I think they're soybeans, John.
This relates to two articles in the journal, this issue. One is a piece of research about vitamin D levels in early childhood. And this was showing that amongst Canadian school children, those who drank non-cow's milk were more likely to have lower levels of vitamin D. I don't think there was any cases of rickets as such, but certainly there was a fairly clear association with non-cow's milk consumption and lower levels of vitamin D. And the other is a commentary on that research. So, Kirsten, you commissioned the commentary. What's the message on milk?
The main message of the commentary is that not all milks are created equal. And this comes down to the fortification of milk. Cow's milk has a standard fortification level in terms of vitamin D, but non-cow's milks, which include soy milk, goat's milk, and rice and almond milks, are not subject.
I had no idea there were so many milks.
There are so many milks. They're not subject to standardization in terms of vitamin D levels, and you have to check the labels very carefully. So the commentary is looking at what the researchers found in the study, and it concludes that non-cow's milk beverages, including goat's milk and plant-based milk alternatives, are fortified with vitamin D at the discretion of the manufacturer, and that parents, caregivers should be alert to this when choosing milks for their children to ensure that they get enough vitamin D.
There's quite a lot in this issue about food. One of the bits of research that I'm pleased that we've got in is a randomized controlled trial, rather large one, called the PREDIMED trial, about 2,300 people, looking at the effects primarily on cardiovascular outcomes of the Mediterranean diet. It's slightly more complicated than that because the two interventions in this trial were Mediterranean diets plus nuts or Mediterranean diets plus quite a lot of olive oil. One of the strengths, in a sense, of this trial was that the intervention was not too draconian. It was just advice, which makes it all the more surprising that they did find this reduction in cardiovascular events, published in another journal. But the outcome that we're publishing this issue is that of the effect of the Mediterranean diet on the metabolic syndrome. Now, of course, most people recruited into this trial were overweight or had some abnormalities in cholesterol or blood sugar. So a lot of them were almost bound to get metabolic syndrome. But those on the Mediterranean diet interventions were more likely to recover from, i.e. that is, revert back to normal from the metabolic syndrome. So of those who had it, and took the Mediterranean diet, there was a hazard ratio of 1.35, that is, they were more likely, 35% more likely, to recover from the metabolic syndrome and go the other side of the line. So this is, as I say, quite an encouraging result, secondary outcome of the trial, of course, so more research is needed, and it doesn't apply to everybody because this was a fairly specific group, but encouraging in that this was advice and nothing too difficult to follow.
That's great. That's really encouraging.
It's an eternal puzzle, isn't it? I mean, in Western society, people are growing larger. More and more of them are becoming overweight. And in a sense, that's clearly because we're eating too much. Consume more calories than you use up, and your weight goes up. That's simple, but the answer isn't quite so simple. How do we actually get people to lower their consumption? And that was something that you and I wrote the editorial on. What was the message of that editorial?
Well, our editorial was tagged on the study that was published in another journal last year that looked at worldwide rates of obesity in the last decade and showed that across the board, whether it's Western countries or developing countries, obesity is on the rise. And There are a lot of interventions, targets to reduce obesity by a certain date, to end childhood obesity by the year 2030. And we were considering in our editorial, what would that take? Well, the missing piece of the puzzle is government leadership and government action on high fat, high salt, high sugar, unhealthy foods. Governments are offering public health advice to the individual, but can they take action to tax high fat and unhealthy foods, or to make sure that healthier foods are more available, more accessible and more cheap, and unhealthy foods are more expensive?
So a sort of a calorie tax.
This is where we always get criticism. People will say, how can you tax unhealthy foods, because it is people who are underprivileged and or who cannot do not have the purchasing power to buy healthy foods that will buy unhealthy foods primarily. So then we are taxing the poor. But I think it is more complex than that. For government to be seen to be taking action to make unhealthy foods less widely accessible and healthier food choices more widely accessible.
So I think we should get off the subject of food, if that's at all possible now. Is there any medicine in this issue of the journal?
Well, I think we've got a bulging practice bulging. Section. We've got articles in the practice section which are very clinically focused. And one of the things that we're covering, which you mentioned in our last podcast, is articles related to Choosing Wisely Canada, which is about stopping doing things that you would ordinarily do because they're unhelpful.
So two main areas, there's a five things article and a decisions article. What should we be doing less of?
In this issue, we're looking at some nasogastric feeding in dementia.
PEG feeding, the percutaneous feeding in patients with dementia.
Absolutely. It's about this artificial feeding and how it shouldn't be used as a first line, that there are ways that you can use to get patients to eat normally and still be nutritionally well.
Yes, a lot harder work, certainly, feeding patients with dementia. What struck me about that was that there appears to be no evidence that putting in a tube actually prolongs life or makes patients happier, which would seem to be an important outcome.
Exactly, and it's associated with lots of agitation, increased use of restraints, and pressure ulcers in many cases.
So it's
harmful too.
Something to consider not doing.
Absolutely.
Something I would never have considered doing, I must say, was a needle washout in patients with osteoarthritis of the knee, but that's one of the ones that we're asked not to do. One of the things I would have considered was glucosamine, and I must say I'm slightly disappointed that I can no longer recommend glucosamine to people with osteoarthritis, but it seems to be that there isn't much evidence to support it.
I remember when the first meta-analyses started coming out about glucosamine and chondroitin, there was much of the same disbelief, and many primary care practitioners said, well, if patients are willing to pay for it, there might be some minor benefit and I'll continue advising them to use it. But now it seems clearer that there is actually no benefit at all to using glucosamine in preventing the progression of osteoarthritis or improving the symptoms.
So something we should, as doctors, think about not doing. And I think really the guidance coming out from Choosing Wisely Canada is making us think again about what really works and concentrating our efforts in areas that where we know there's evidence, and perhaps causing us to pause and discuss with our patients things that might not be beneficial.
And what I'm finding really beneficial about these articles is that they highlight the harms that perhaps haven't been thought about, that there are usually attendant harms with things that we think are harmless.
So one of the articles that I do hope will be useful to clinicians is the update of the Canadian Cardiovascular National Guidelines, the Sea Change Guidelines. Quite a lot of things have changed and updates and things. What were the highlights for you?
Well, what really interested me was that they have now started to recommend that we measure BMI in children aged 2 to 17.
Because they have cardiovascular disease?
Well, no, because high BMI in childhood is now recognized as a risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
So this is taking prevention right back to childhood?
Absolutely. And then there are updated recommendations regarding salt intake in patients with hypertension, and a lot of changes in the recommendations on how to treat patients with diabetes, another risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
So worth reading to keep up to date with the changes in practice.
Yes, because they're looking at 8 guidelines and harmonising the recommendations from those 8.
So did you read the What's Your Call This issue?
Yeah, it's a very interesting article about a middle-aged man who's having hallucinations.
This was an unemployed immigrant to Canada who came in complaining about spirits possessing him and voices in his head. Turns out that he had a physical explanation for the diagnosis.
What was it?
Well, I wouldn't want to give anything away because half the fun of What's Your Call is working through it. Suffice it to say that I'm pleased to say that one of the things on my list was neurosyphilis, because that would go with anything neurological, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
That wasn't the diagnosis, but in the true tradition of TV dramas, a patient got high-dose steroids as part of their treatment. But I won't give away whether that cured him or not. I'll read the What's Your Call. Kirsten, you've been putting together some interesting stuff on the back page, and I know we're actually reviewing that for the December issue. So this is, I think, the last Salon, where you've given us a head-to-head for two opposing views about end-of-life care.
John, this is a kind of a transition article from the old Salon to the new back page, which as yet remains nameless and will be revealed in the first issue in December. Now, what we've done here is we've taken two articles from CMAJ blogs, shortened them and put them side by side, and they are two views on the assisted dying debate from some prominent voices in that area.
So tell me about what do you think?
Well, that's interesting because I think we all have a slightly different view at CMAJ of what we would want the outcome of the law to be. I think if I consider it purely for myself, I would like that option to be available to me one day. I would like to have the choice, much in the way that for example, and this has been a comparison that's been made, the abortion law was not about saying abortion is right, it's about saying women have the choice as to what they do with their bodies. And I think I would like the choice, which is interesting. One of the two sides in our last Salon article says that in places where assisted dying has been legalized, just being given the choice sometimes makes people feel much more comfortable about not choosing assisted dying.
And I think, I mean, James Downer expresses this view quite well and points out that really, I think, quite a large proportion of people in Canada and doctors would be in favour of some kind of physician-assisted death.
However, if you look at the argument on the other side, it's also really understandable is that physicians don't want to be the people who have to carry it out. What do you think about it, John?
Well, there is the other side, and Tom Koch is putting the other side. I feel uncomfortable with the whole notion of doctors presiding over the death of their patients. And while I respect the argument that people might wish to choose to end their lives, I think death and killing people is never a good thing. It may be something that is a last option. But I see the law as setting boundaries on what we do and protecting the vulnerable. And Tom Koch espouses this quite well, to say that the intention of Canada's laws was to preserve the sanctity of life and to preserve equality and freedom of choice, but not necessarily freedom to die. So we have it there, both views expressed in the back pages of Salon, and this debate's going to be going on for some time before it's settled, I'm sure. That wraps up this issue of the CMAJ podcast on November the 18th. John Fletcher and Kirsten Patrick.